This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Lately, the cold and snow has been hard on Istanbul, Turkey, and terrible for Bulgaria and the Ukraine. In Moscow, the Orthodox holiday was the coldest Christmas night in 120 years. I don't have to tell people in the U.S. Midwest or Northeast or Canada about driving Arctic cold and extra snow. Maybe you've heard of the Arctic vortex. How is this all happening under global warming? We'll cover that, but there is something else, a condition that helps weather specialists predict the kind of winter that's coming. To help us understand, I've reached Dr. Judah Cohen. He's worked at the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies when James Hansen was the director. Cohen has been a research scientist at MIT Parsons Laboratory. Since 1998, he's continued to publish scientific papers while employed by the weather consulting company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Governments, the military, and private industry are helped by his work as he teases climate science into the near future. From Lexington, Massachusetts, Dr. Cohen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
In late December 2016, January 2017, there are waves of abnormally cold weather, sometimes with heavy snow across the northern hemisphere. It seems to be a parade of slightly warmer weather and then crushing cold we associate with the Arctic. Judah, is that an accurate picture?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's been, I think the headlines have been about the cold weather, the snow, and here in North America, but also in Europe and East Asia. You know, crushing cold with a little bit of warmth, I guess that depends where you live. I mean, the cold has been focused further west in North America. Here in the East Coast, it's kind of been a toss-up, which has been winning out. So it's always, I guess, it's, you know, the weather, very much sensitive to weather that's happening in your own backyard, just to be clear on that.
Yeah, that's true. You know, we had cold snaps when I was growing up in Canada, but we assumed what happened in the Arctic stayed in the Arctic. Is that still true, or has something changed?
Yeah, that's a very big debate in the climate community, and something that has been an ongoing debate for a few years, and we're going to have actually a workshop in the beginning of February where we're going to all get together, many of the leading scientists in this topic, and try to come to a consensus, but the consensus still doesn't exist. I personally am in the camp that believes that what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, but I would characterize that most of the community believes that what happens in the Arctic does stay in the Arctic. I mean, I think, you know, this year is a good example. I think a lot of the recent years are good examples of that we've had these simultaneous extreme warmths in the Arctic. Certainly part of that is attributed to low sea ice, not all of it, but some of it is attributed to that low sea ice. And yet the expectations, the projections were that warmth in the Arctic would kind of spread out to lower latitudes, and everybody, you know, the whole northern hemisphere would warm, you know, in concert with the warming of the Arctic. And I've tried to argue, and others as well, that hasn't been the case, that actually when the Arctic warms, especially when it warms at extremely, I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, it's when you get this extreme warmth in the Arctic, that actually favors these outbreaks of more severe or extreme winter weather, including cold snaps and snowstorms. And there certainly doesn't seem to be any lack of examples of that this year. And it's certainly been also what I think is this year makes a good example is that it hasn't been isolated to one location. You know, it's not just one place, but it's been kind of an equal opportunity, you know, winter where many places across the globe, like you started, you know, you mentioned in your introduction, have experienced pretty wild winter weather with, you know, what I would characterize as extreme cold and extreme snowfall.
Do you think that's going to be true for the UK, Scandinavia, and Europe, or are they safer somehow sliding between these two big continents?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the winter isn't over, and certainly the weather models are suggestive that cold air will head towards Western Europe. So it's certainly been focused, you know, so far this month in Eastern Europe, Southeast Europe, I mean, Turkey and Greece and Italy, they've all, I know, you know, certainly the pictures have come out of there with these incredible snowfalls and the extreme cold temperatures in, you know, Moscow, Poland, and the Balkans, and Bulgaria. But the weather models are suggesting that cold, I don't think to that intensity, but that cold will start sliding further west. And so I think the United Kingdom, you know, will certainly get a taste of it, maybe even possibly some snow. But UK is a very difficult place to forecast snow. and it doesn't happen that often because they stick so far out in the ocean and are very close to the Gulf Stream. But we'll see. It should be some interesting couple of weeks coming up.
So what's the debate among scientists about whether the deep snows and the cold hitting the northeastern U.S. in recent years is or is not related to the shrinking Arctic sea ice?
Yeah, so the majority of the climate community believes or agrees that the cold that we've experienced has been really random, or it's been by chance, that, you know, there's a lot of variability in the system and the climate system, and, you know, sometimes it comes out warm, sometimes it comes out cold, so, you know, you have a couple of, even a streak of two or three cold winters. You know, that's just, you know, good luck, bad luck, depending on your perspective, but it's really just luck. And I've certainly not been in that camp. I don't believe in coincidences that strongly, and I think it has to be put in the context, in the framework, that the projections have been for, you know, pretty rapidly warming winter season, that cold and snow would become a rare event, and it doesn't seem to be the case. That over the past decade, I would argue that the headlines have more been about severe winter weather and less about, you know, record warmth and a lack of winter.
Yeah, in 2006 I did a show about whether winter sports would be over, and that certainly hasn't been the case. And I can remember, it wasn't, maybe around 2009, 2010, people were playing tennis in New York in January, and we thought, well, that's it, winter's over. But winter isn't over.
Yeah, no, and there have been some famous articles in the New York Times, you know, where people are bemoaning or, you know, kind of putting a eulogy to snow in New York City, and that certainly seems premature. Last winter they had their record biggest snowstorm. You know, it's not just isolated to New York, but that's been in other places as well. But yeah, there have been these projections that winter's over. You know, it's something that our fathers experience, or, you know, maybe we experience if we're a little older, but our children won't really experience that type of winter weather. And so far, I don't think, you know, it's been that the winters have, I mean, they're different. I mean, things are changing, and so I don't want to oversimplify. I mean, certainly, I think winters are starting later. The falls have been very warm, and I think maybe the fall is the season that's been warming the fastest, which was supposed to be the winter, but that's not happening. So, I mean, there is this shifting in the seasons. I mean, it's thus, I don't know if winters are ending any sooner. I know overall people report that the freezing season or the snowfall season is getting shorter. But, you know, so there are definitely shifts, and I would characterize that the winter, you know, the season of winter weather maybe has been getting shorter, but when it does happen, it seems to be getting more intense.
Let's look at some of the tools that you and all scientists use when they study these matters. For example, what is the Arctic Oscillation?
Yeah, so the Arctic Oscillation, I think the easiest way to understand it, it's just a metric. It measures the exchange of air masses between the high latitudes and the low latitudes. So when the Arctic Oscillation is positive, there's very little mixing of air masses going on. So the cold air stays over the Arctic, the warmer air stays over the mid-latitudes, right? You have this strong kind of temperature gradient, but then across the mid-latitudes, it tends to be you have a milder pattern, warmer temperatures, less snowfall, because the respective air masses are staying where they're supposed to be, right? So what happens in the Arctic stays in the Arctic kind of idea. And then when you have a negative Arctic oscillation, that means there's much more mixing of the air masses going on. So the Arctic air, the cold air, doesn't stay in the Arctic now. It's displaced southward into the mid-latitudes, and then warm air that's at lower and mid-latitudes rushes into the Arctic, and you get these kind of extreme warm events. And you get this more extreme or severe winter weather in the mid-latitudes because also the mixing of air masses is conducive to storms, and if it's cold enough, brings you snowstorms.
Can we predict when this Arctic oscillation will shift? Do we know that yet?
Again, most of the field has express this idea that the Arctic Oscillation is kind of random. It's just kind of a measure of the noise or the randomness in the system, and therefore it's unpredictable. I've tried to predict the Arctic Oscillation, and this is for the winter season. It exists all year round, but because what we're talking about today is really the winter season. And I've tried to prove or support the idea that it can be predicted using a Eurasian snow cover. So if you look at snow cover across Eurasia in the month of October, that can kind of give you an indication of the Arctic oscillation. So when the snow cover is high, that predicts, or let's say the odds are tilted towards a negative Arctic oscillation. So more of this mixing of the air masses between the high and lower latitudes, maybe more severe winter weather across the mid-latitudes. And when that snow cover is low, then that kind of portends or predicts a positive Arctic oscillation. Less mixing of the air masses, the cold air stays in the Arctic, the warmer air stays in the mid-latitudes, you have a milder winter. As I get along in my career, I do think that the Arctic oscillation itself is an overly simplistic metric, and I've actually kind of shifted away from the Arctic oscillation more towards the kind of a framework of the polar vortex, which is the same idea. But I think there are times when you get these outbreaks of severe cold and snow, and doesn't really match up with what's going on with this Arctic oscillation, just the way it's constructed. But I think there's a strong relationship with what's happening with the polar vortex. And just like when you have a negative Arctic oscillation, the strong mixing, the same thing happens with a weak polar vortex. When you have much more mixing of the air mass, that tends to weaken the polar vortex, which is this kind of this low pressure that sits in the stratosphere right over the North Pole and, spins around very quickly. The air circulates around the polar vortex in a west-east direction. And when the vortex is very strong, that kind of keeps those air masses between the Arctic and the lower latitudes separated, right? It acts like a fence or a dam. And, similar to when you have a positive Arctic oscillation. And then when you have a weakening of the polar vortex and the winds start to meander more in the north-south direction, you get much more mixing of the air masses, warm air rushes into the polar stratosphere that weakens the polar vortex, sometimes very quite dramatically. And then that cold air that was confined inside of that polar vortex then spills out to mid-latitudes and you get this more severe winter weather. So that's kind of, I've tried to move my thinking, my framework, more towards this kind of polar vortex type context, more so than the Arctic oscillation, I think, at least for winter. In the summer, there is no polar vortex, so it doesn't work at all. But at least for the winter, I think maybe it's a better indicator of the type of weather you could expect. In these areas that we discuss, United States, Southern Canada, Europe, and as well East Asia also.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Judah Cohen, and we're talking about winters and predicting winters. And he's from the American company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Judah, until a few years ago, the public never heard of the Arctic vortex. Why did it suddenly appear in TV weather forecasting?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, it really came to be used in the media in January 2014. There was a very strong Arctic outbreak beginning of that month. It was like a January 6th, 7th, record cold to the Midwest and then the eastern United States, southern Canada as well, southeastern Canada. And, the media picked it up. People take credit for it. I don't know. I don't think it was actually the best example, of like the poster child for using the polar vortex. I think the winter before that, 2012-13, would have been a much better example. But at first I was horrified, because I thought they were, not using it in the proper context. Because again, the polar vortex in the purest sense sits in the stratosphere, and they were talking about something that is here in the troposphere, in the weather, the atmosphere closer to the ground. But since then, we can't beat them, join them. I've come to embrace much more this use of the term polar vortex. And I do think that used properly, that it can give quite a bit of insight into the upcoming weather. And again, I'm trying to predict these different phases or stages of the polar vortex, the strong versus weak. I think it's actually there are more different configurations to the polar vortex than just, it's not just a binary system. It's not just strong or weak, but there are other different flavors, let's say, to the polar vortex that, can be used for prediction and the prediction, in the longer term, not just, we use our weather models to maybe make the forecast for the next week, 10 days possibly, but then it really falls apart. I think, and we can, by understanding these different configurations or these different phases. I don't know maybe what's the best word to use that your audience will understand and be able to internalize the concept I'm trying to get across. But scientifically, I guess we'd say the different phases of the polar vortex. I think that could be used to make these longer range forecasts, you know, 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, even like 4 weeks or longer. I think it was a good addition and a kind of a different perspective. I mean, it's an idea that's been around in meteorology for a very long time. It wasn't invented in 2014. You know, it's something that's been discussed for decades before that.
So just to be clear, though, in scientific terms, you're thinking that the real polar vortex is way up in the upper atmosphere, the stratospheric polar vortex, but now we're starting to use it for lower-level weather?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. So really, in the pure sense, and what, you know, climatologists and meteorologists, when we talked about the polar vortex, was really in the stratosphere, which is like, you know, 10 miles up in the atmosphere. And then when it was used colloquially in 2014, right, by the media, it was really talking about the weather closer to the surface. So there's something analogous that goes on in the weather to the surface to the polar vortex, but I mean, I think that has kind of gotten muddled and confused. And but there's this connection, this relationship between what happens in the stratosphere and the troposphere, not all the time, but sometimes. And I think that can be capitalized to improve longer range forecasts. So.
And I'd like to look at a couple of predictions you made in October 2016. First, for the United States, you predicted a colder and more snowy winter from the plains to the northeast. How's that panning out?
Yeah, so, looking at North America, we had cold in western Canada and then kind of coming southeastward into the plains, the Great Lakes, and into the northeast. So eastern New England, I think, was above normal. So the jury's still out on that. The cold further west, you know, in the plains, I think western Canada, that looks to work out. I think the northeast, a lot of it will come down to how February shapes up. But, I think, you know, it's a toss-up. I think temperatures are pretty close to normal if you average, you know, the temperatures from December 1st right through today. But we do have a much milder period coming up, so that'll probably tilt it back into the warm column. But again, a cold February, I think, will tilt the whole winter to cold. So, you know, the jury's still out on how. I mean, in certain parts of the forecast, I think, you know, the cold in the western part of the forecast region, western Canada, the plains of the United States, I think that's looking pretty good.
Yeah, we had pipe freezing cold here in British Columbia. I mean, it was very unusual cold. I want to move on, though. Secondly, you agreed with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, when they said dry weather would predominate in California. And in the second week of January, the whole Pacific coast was drenched with an atmospheric river of extreme rainfall, plus snow in the mountains. Could that be enough to break the long drought in California? What's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a hydrologist. I don't think I came out with a forecast. We do have, you know, produce a precipitation forecast. I don't think I really talked about it in the public, but it probably did agree with NOAA. I will fully admit that our precipitation forecast heavily relies on the phase of the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is what NOAA is using to make their precipitation forecast as well. So I'm going to have to check on it. I mean, I probably was. Our forecast was for dry in California, so I won't deny, but I don't remember coming out publicly with that. But obviously, you know, there's, you know, a tremendous amount of moisture that California has gotten already and is still predicted to get. It should make a big difference in the drought. I don't know if it'll completely erase it. I mean, some of the issues there is that right now it's pretty warm, so they're getting more rain and snow, and the most beneficial for them is snow and not rain. But, I mean, they've gotten a lot of snow, and I guess it'll continue to snow at the higher elevations, but it's a pretty warm system, it seems like. At least currently it's warmer. I assume it'll get colder, and the snow levels will come down. But it should make a big difference. But this is not, it's not my expertise.
But you do seem to be a hybrid mix because, you know, in my opinion, too many meteorologists won't take advantage of climate change science, and then most climate scientists won't talk about the coming winter at all. They want to talk about decades at least. How did you bridge these two fields?
Yeah, so it's a point I think I don't get enough credit for, and I certainly get a lot of grief. You know, I'm one of the few, maybe really the only, I don't know anybody else at the top of my head. You know, climate scientists, a guy who's publishing papers. I mean, there are people that are putting out forecasts, but, you know, the people that are in the private sector, let's say, or even in the government labs that are putting out these forecasts, they're not really conducting research. And the ones that are conducting research and publishing the scientific journal articles aren't putting out forecasts. And I feel like I'm pretty unique in that, in doing both the research and the forecast. And I do think that it is, well, it certainly helped guide, you know, one has helped, the research has helped guide the forecast, and the forecast have helped guide the research. And I think, and I would argue, people might say differently, but I would argue it's been to my benefit. You know, it's one thing to put out research ideas and kind of live in this, you know, academic ivory tower where, you know, even if it's complete nonsense and doesn't improve forecasts, you don't really care because you're not involved with making forecasts. That's someone else's problem. But, I mean, I don't have that luxury. You know, if I put out an idea and I'm saying this is going to improve seasonal, long-range forecasting, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm making these forecasts. It's being given to clients or being made public, and certainly trying not to embarrass myself at the same time. Now, the forecasts are certainly not perfect, but I think I've had a very good track record of these public forecasts. I think our forecasts that we make here today have been the best, certainly in the winter season. And I think it's been a very good and healthy exercise, and I would recommend to other scientists to also try to, you know, if you really believe strongly in an idea, that there's no better way to prove or to test that idea than to make a forecast and see if it verifies.
Well, you know, as we talked about, we kind of hoped winter would be over with global warming, but how are we ever going to tell billions of humans, if you experience a harsher winter, it's because the world is warming? How can we tell them that?
You know, I've had an interesting experience with saying how Arctic change is influencing the winter weather. People have, you know, called me, an apologist for global warming or climate change, or even people call me a denier of climate change. I think people, it's gotten very politicized, very polarized, like much of the politics. And I don't have any good answers. I mean, again, I myself try to keep an open mind and seeing how our climate's changing, and then trying to, you know, be opportunistic about it to improve long range forecasting. But I think it's a very difficult and almost maybe intractable problem. I don't have any good answers for you, because people see what they want to see. You know, I guess I've been around long enough at least to get, you know, and have that type of philosophy ingrained in me. But I mean, I really focus on just making a better forecast and not trying to, you know, convince people, you know, what to believe or not to believe.
So why are these forecasts so important? I mean, who uses this information? Why do we need it?
Well, I think, you know, being prepared is important. I mean, first of all, if you know, so, I mean, traditionally our clients have been people in the energy sector. If you know what the winter is going to be, if it's going to be a cold winter or a warm winter, you can position your assets, whatever, your money, you know, to make the best opportunity of that. So if it's a cold winter, you know, you want to invest in oil and gas, you know, whatever, but I mean, maybe gas is more sensitive, natural gas more sensitive than oil to the weather. But, you know, that type of thing. I mean, that's just, you know, a very basic and investment-oriented perspective. But, you know, even from a public, the government, in the public sector, if you're a city and if you think there could be a chance of a lot of snowfall, so, you know, you prepare for that as well. Maybe you have enough salt, you have enough snow plows, you know, available, and, you know, then, you know, let's say maybe, you know, you're expecting less snow, you could prepare for that as well. So, I think both in the private and the public sector, the weather has a big impact, and being prepared for the possible scenarios and outcomes, you know, can be very useful. Save money, make people's lives easier as well.
Where do you think climate science has to go to help meteorologists become more certain about near-term predictions?
Most of the field has relied on these dynamical models for prediction. I mean, it is a tough question you asked me. But since you asked, I'm gonna, I'll answer it. And again, this is really my own opinion and no one else's. But You know, we've built these dynamical models, and they're very good, and they've made tremendous improvements in forecasting, but they certainly have their limitations. And I think, you know, the atmosphere, you know, in theory, there could be every day, in that, you know, of weather could be different than the day before, and no 2 days are ever alike, you know, like snowflakes. But the atmosphere, I think, you know, it does something interesting. It likes to fall into certain types of patterns. It repeats these patterns over and over again. And I think, you know, you come to appreciate that, you know, in climate science. And, you know, so I think that's an area that, you know, I've tried to exploit. And I think there can be, you know, a benefit. Now, you know, I feel like the field has really kind of become more and more reliant on these dynamical models where they're solving the equations, these physical equations explicitly. They're, you know, crunching them out with the computer. But I think, and I think we should certainly move in that direction, but I also think we've kind of moved away from this kind of pattern recognition. Old-timey meteorologists like to talk about analogs, which I'm actually not the greatest fan of, but I think we can use pattern. I'm using pattern recognition, you know, kind of this idea. I'm not a computer. This idea of recognizing patterns. So like I said, high snow cover, like I said earlier, high snow cover leads to a colder winter, that type of pattern recognition or relationship. I think more of that could improve these, you know, longer range forecasts. That's certainly where I've, you know, focused my own energy and research on. So, I mean, it's a very subjective answer, admittedly, and someone else would, I'm sure, give you a very, very different answer.
You know, I could see it's possible that artificial intelligence may eventually help us. We're dealing with these gigantic data sets of global information. It's possible that some machine just going over and over and over that may bring out a new pattern that we hadn't thought about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the point you make is a great one, and I agree with that.
As we finish up here, is there anything else you'd like to add to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just traditionally, you know, the climate community has relied on the tropics for making these longer range forecasts, that only the tropics were thought to really be able to influence the weather in the mid-latitudes. And, you know, myself and some others, we've really said, especially given the rapid changes that are going in the Arctic, the changes are much larger than happening anywhere else across the globe, that these rapid changes in the Arctic, I think, is providing, I don't know, more opportunities. Not something like the right way to put it, but increases the likelihood that the Arctic is influencing the weather in the mid-latitudes just because the changes are so large there. And I think that it does provide us with an additional or new capabilities or abilities to improve our forecasts, you know, in the mid-latitudes. And certainly something that I'm really very much focused on is kind of trying to use both the tropics and the Arctic to complement each other, you know, synergistically to improve, you know, long-range forecasts. Really, I think, has been kind of the cornerstone of my career so far. So, I mean, there's one, you know, one thought I'd like to leave everybody with is, you know, that embracing the idea that we can bring in, you know, Arctic variability and Arctic change into improving these long-range forecasts across the whole Northern Hemisphere.
We've been speaking with Dr. Judah Cohen from the Company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. He's a much-published scientist whose seasonal weather predictions ran counter to some established expectations, but he's been pretty accurate. He's been on television and often sought out by journalists. I'll put links to Judah's information and a couple of key papers he recommends in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Judah, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, again, you know, it was a pleasure to talk about all my favorite subjects, so happy to do so.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.